It's time for the Dynamics Podcast. Joining us today from Prague is Microsoft MVP Martin Drab. We're also going to talk to Dave Frostley from the Fargo office at Microsoft. We're going to talk to them about development, extensibility, extensions versus overlayering, and a lot of other stuff that has to do with development. It's really interesting. You should really pay attention, so stay tuned.
This is the Dynamics Podcast, Episode 16, recorded June 6, 2017, Extension and Development, with Martin Drab and Dave Frosley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dynamics Podcast. My name, of course, is Felix Sartre, and joining me today is my Superman to my Jimmy. Hello, Tommy.
Hi, Felix. How are you, man?
It's summer. It's you said last time there was snow. Is it gone now? Hopefully.
Well, no. Not, up in the mountains, there is still some snow, but we're getting more and more sun. And I've been up like 300-400 meters up high and with no snow in the mountains. But further up, there is snow.
Yeah. I was... it was Ascension Day, was it? Now? Just... I don't know. Yeah. One of these Christian holidays. And so we had Monday off, and I went up to drove across Hardangervidda. There was a lot of snow up in the mountains. It's a good not that should kind of deter Donald Trump for thinking about global warming. It's still happening, but you know, yeah. And yeah, so today we've got a very developer intense group with us, right? So
yeah,
gotta welcome our guests today. Hello, Martin. And Dave. Hi.
Hello, guys.
Yeah. So we'll do an introduction. Maybe Martin, you can do an introduction where you are and what you do and how'd you get there.
Well, I'm in Prague. Regarding AX, I worked with it for like 12 years, starting with AX3 as a developer, of course. And now, I work as a freelancer, doing some development architecture, doing some training, so even advanced development workshops for Microsoft, and well, like a bit jumping from one project to another, seeing lots of different things. So it's quite fun. And of course, I do lots of work on community and community forums. On the other hand, I have less time for my blog, but sometimes I also add something there.
Have you done a word count? Because that's kind of a recurring theme. We talk about Martin's ability to write on the forum. You write like constantly, 24/7. If somebody has a technical question, it will be answered like in 5 minutes by Martin. Are you trying to go for Andre's record, or is it just by passion?
I don't care about records. Now some people are much more active than I am, and you know, I have like sometimes I work more on it because I have time, or so sometimes I don't have enough time. I don't mind. It's more like I do it for a long time already. Now there are more active people, and it's all right. I don't feel much. I would like more and more active moderators, so I don't have to do all that work. It takes me time, and it's not really visible. So I that's something I really like. I'm definitely not afraid of that there will be too many people helping in community.
No, an honest soul. And also, where can you find your stuff? You have a blog, which is. Where do we go to find your blog?
Well, my blog, actually, I don't have really nice URL now. I have domain goshum.net, and on dev, I have my development blog, devgoshum.net. And I used to write it in Czech and English, so every article had version in Czech and version in English. So now English version is at, you know, devgoshim.net/n, en. Now I do it on only in English. It was just too time consuming. And originally I started blogging in Czech. There was absolutely no resource in Czech at the time. And I continued to do it for some time, but then, you know, it just the impact wasn't good, you know, enough for spending so much time with it. So very often I had blog posts in one language, but it took me another week before I translated it to the other one. So I just gave it up, and now the only the English version is the only active one. You always can find links from signature in my blog, our blog post, the community forum contribution. Always click there and
And also on Twitter.
I have to add, Martin, your blog is one of my favorite blogs because you have that deep, hardcore content for developers. And I remember when I started working with AX, I always went back to your blog post to find valuable content. So I'm really glad that I didn't have to learn Czech to read your posts. But I got to ask, Gashum, what does that mean? Is it a Czech word or where does it come from?
Not really. It's a long story. It's basically a character from a book.
Okay.
It's not a DJ name.
It was written in Czech. This is like English subscription. That the pronunciation is similar.
Okay. Cool.
So what is the pronunciation?
Gushum.
Gushum. All right. So, Dave.
Yeah, but obviously, I didn't thought when I got this nickname that at some point I would have some blog post or blog about AX and people would ask me this question all the time.
Well, you're stuck with it now. Very nice. So, Dave, you work for Microsoft. So, what's your background?
I do work for Microsoft. I just crossed 15 years working for Microsoft, all up here at the Fargo, beautiful sunny Fargo, now that it's summertime here as well. And I've done a few different things during my time. I've been in different management roles in both the development discipline and the test discipline. I've spent time as a test architect, where it helped drive our test strategy. And recently, I've been working on customization. I've worked on it in the past a little bit, and last few months jumped into this application extensibility project that we're going to talk some about today, as well as still stay involved in some test-related stuff and doing more and more in the analytics space as well, learning from our telemetry and other things like that. Before that, I worked down in the Minneapolis area for quite a few years, and I worked for a company that tested planes and cars and other mechanical things, tested them structurally. So we built these big machines that we would use to structurally test these vehicles. It's pretty interesting company. So that's my background.
All right. In the Fargo office, I know that GP is pretty big up there.
Yes.
Are you co-located with those or
them already? Yeah. So the heritage of this office is Microsoft purchased Great Plains Software in 2001, which was a year before I started. And we bought Navision in 2002, right after I started. And those two products from each of the companies came together to become our ERP suite. What we do in Fargo now is primarily we have what we call the small business segment, which focuses on Nav and GP. And then we have a lot of formerly known as AX developers, Microsoft Dynamics 365 Finance and Operations Enterprise Edition, to get it right. So that's kind of the split. But then also in the Fargo office, we have a really strong support contingent. We have quite a few people doing what we call shared services, which is mostly internal business finance related things. And then we've over the last year or so, we've started a pretty significant inside sales office as well here in Fargo. So it's we have three buildings. I think it's about 1,600 people that work on the campus here.
All right.
That's cool. And also Fargo, as far as I know, Fargo has a lot of Scandinavians. If you go way back in time.
This is very true. My dad spoke Norwegian. He that's what he learned growing up in his home, and he'd go down to the post office in the mornings when I was a kid and talk Norwegian with all the other gentlemen in the community that had that heritage. So yeah, I'm not too far removed from that Scandinavian background.
That's just something you gotta love, Fredrik. Yeah, I guess.
Of course, you always invite Scandinavians on.
I figured that was my primary qualification, Tommy, for being invited to this esteemed affair.
Of course.
No, you did presentations on the technical conference on for developers, and I remember you also did talks on you said testing, and along with Joris and other PGs. And I wanted to bring you on because I think we should talk about the developer experience with AX and how it has somehow evolved from previous versions of AX until what we have today. And I also wanted to bring on Martin because I know he's a hardcore .NET developer and he has a ton of experience with utilizing the new developer story, and also is in contact with a lot of the community out there, as part of both being a presenter and doing teaching and in contact with professionals and ISVs. So I, that's what I wanted to do. At least that's my intention with this podcast, is to have a look at how the gap is being bridged between the versions and how the language is also evolving. And testing is one thing that it seems to be of high interest. Just a few weeks ago, Martin made a blog post on testing and how you can utilize, you did sort of convey of trying how you can do testing using some mock-up framework. Isn't that so, Martin?
Well, not exactly, because if I understand what you are talking about, I had a blog post about using IOC containers, which focused not really on testing directly, but on extensibility. This dealing with loose coupling and being able to replace one component with another is also very important for testing, where you want to run testing some class, for example, and you don't want to test everything below it. So you want to isolate that piece that you want to test. So that's definitely something where this kind of things is very useful. When we are dealing with extensibility in AX, that's also where you can use it basically for configuring your system, saying instead of this class, I want to use this my own class with like subclass with some different behavior. So I was not focusing on how to exactly do it in AX. I was just demonstrating how the principle works in general. Well, trying to do it directly in AX, it's possibly next step. I intended it more like something to think about, and maybe that's something that Microsoft could support directly. I don't know. It was really just to show it. I have some ideas about using mocking frameworks and things like that, and I spent some time playing with these things. I'm not where I would like to be with it. It's quite a challenge.
No, but it's also the way the language has evolved enables us to adopt new, more modern patterns that we see being used in the .NET developer world that we couldn't so much do in previous versions. Throwing back to you, Dave, do you see yourself adopting the new platform for enabling, for instance, better test coverage?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I've had some on and off discussions with the ecosystem about test, and about, I don't know, probably 5 years ago in AX 2012 time, we tried to get some traction with better test tools and more focus on testing in the ecosystem, and there wasn't a ton of interest was the bottom line. I mean, there's interest, but maybe not investment. At the tech conference, Joris and I did a session on testing, and it was the last session of the last day, and I wasn't very optimistic about attendance, to put it bluntly. But there was actually quite a lot attending, and I'm seeing a lot more usage of our SysTest framework in the ecosystem, and just a lot more interest in general. And it ties in with this topic, as Martin kind of alluded to. You know, one of the key benefits that we see about extensions over overlayering or less intrusive customization is being able to move from release to release with much less cost and overhead. And part of that story is having a contract that you don't break, that we don't break, so that it's easier to move code forward. But another part of it is, you know, having better test, automated test coverage, so that you can do it without a huge investment from the customer. So they do tie together.
Right. And perhaps over time, I mean, there are some historical code coming on the new platform from the previous versions, and they may or may not have been built for actually tests and testing. But now with how AX is evolving on the language side, more and more professionals will adopt that. But I can see why you would think not that many people would attend, but you should know that Joris has his own groupies. So whenever he does a session, there has to be a ton of people there anyway. So yeah.
So it was Joris more than anything else. I can probably get on board with that. So.
But are there any other things in addition to the ability to test coverage that you see? Moving the fact that Microsoft is now moving AX away from overlayering, it's been said a lot about that. Maybe you, Dave, could start with commenting. What do you think is the reasons why Microsoft want to do this? Why do they want to go away from overlaying and more into extensions beyond the fact that test coverage and
So testing is a positive side effect. Not only can you do we want to get more test coverage, but extensions, loose coupling, as Martin alluded to, does enable some testing scenarios. But the bigger picture story, I think, is just getting away from code-based overlayering type customizations, which, you know, has been an important feature for the product over the years. But the challenge is that when you customize using this type of approach, it's just really expensive to move to new releases. So people end up staying on releases for a long time, and we all know how fast technology is changing and how quickly improvements come into products these days. And as we've moved to the cloud, it's becoming more and more important for us to be able to move the product forward in a more innovative and rapidly changing way. So we want our customers to be taking advantage of the newest technologies. You know, the great example for me going back to tech conference was all the analytics capability that we've added into the product, and that's been enabled by Power BI. You know, that's not work that we did in our product group. That's in our sister product group. We integrated it in, and now there's a ton of new capability in the product, and we want customers to be able to take advantage of that. So that's really the motivation for us to try to move the ecosystem away from overlayering and into an extension capability. It doesn't mean that there's no customization or no way to change the product to meet your needs. It just means that we're trying to do it in a better engineered way so that we can move the product forward and take customers along for the ride.
Well, so Martin, you've been out there doing workshops and courses, and you've talked to the community and the professional in the ISVs. What type of pains and struggles and potential What do they ask you for help, basically, the most, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, obviously, there are, you know, conflicting interests. So some people just say, well, we wanted our AX and we don't want, you know, we didn't ask for any changes. And now we have to deal with lots of new stuff and learn different programming models and dealing with Azure, etc. In general, I really, you know, the problem with upgrades, that's something that people always seems to underestimate, or at least it sounds like that to me. And they say, we didn't have really a problem with upgrades, but they had. And that was really a blocking issue for many projects. So people say it wasn't a problem and they were all right with it. It's not really the case, in my opinion. Now what they, you know, they need to learn how to work with extensions if they are dealing with stuff that can't be done with overlayering. And there are several different issues that they struggle with. Like they need to learn how to use extensions as such, how it's designed, like table extensions, class extensions, etc. Class extensions are particularly problematic because the model is different than for other extensions, like table query extensions or so. So people expect the same experience, and it's basically based on a bit different approach. What I see is that now, okay, they learn how to use extensions and they try to deal, solve everything with extensions instead of using things like object-oriented programming. So they forget about, before they tried to solve everything with inheritance. Now they forget about inheritance and try to do everything with extensions. And, you know, the lack of object-oriented design skills and event-driven development, things like that, that's really missing a lot, ex developers. So they can't, like, you know, design classes that where dependencies are injected and can be replaced, etc. People are not used to it. And sometimes they say, oh, well, there is nothing like that in standard AX. We do it in the same way. So there is one run-based class and lots of stuff inside it. Well, that's how it works. Another challenge is that simply there are things that you can't do with extensions. Very often you can find some workaround. You need to think, design things in a different way, but in some cases you can't. And then that's a challenge, especially when everything will be locked. So when application suite is locked and it's not really designed for extensibility and there are not, you know, and you can request some extension points and some delegate or some refactoring, but people are afraid of how long will it take. Now you develop something, you go overlay a method, and if you won't be able to do it, what you will do? You will lock a request on connect and wait for weeks, months, you don't know. So I think that's much easier problem with platform and foundation that were locked before. But the application suite is enormous and many places are not really designed very well, or at least not designed for extensibility. No, they were designed like 10 years ago or even more with, you know, it did the job at that point, but we are somewhere else. But there are other things. So, you know, if you wanted to perform well, you need to take performance into account. If you want to be able to easily test it, you need to design it for testability. If you want it to be extensible, you need to design it for extensibility. So it's your responsibility as author of the code or the solution to design it in that way. And regarding extensibility, of course, the problem is that you usually don't want to allow everything. So you need to think about how it will be needed to extend it and then say, okay, so like people will need to provide different validations, so I will offer them some way how to put it there. If you take code that it's not designed in this way, you very, very easily can end up with something that you simply can't extend. With extensibility model in AX, where you can like put pre and post method event handlers, public methods and things like that, and you have more options than usual in, you know, if it was like some C# code or so. But well, there are simple things. If the class is, or the logic is not designed for extensibility, then you are stuck. And if you want to change it, then that would be overlayering.
Mm. So you are picking up some concerns from the people you talk to about how the fact that Microsoft is going to seal the application suite, and the application suite in its current form is not too much designed for extensibility as much as we'd like to.
Yeah, that's correct. Of course, it has long history. Some things were just bought from some partners and so, and you know, really there are things that I remember that the code looked exactly the same in AX3. It's just enormous code base, and it's not realistic to expect that somebody will go and refactor the whole thing.
No.
So that would be nice. I would love to see it, but we can't really expect it. So if we want to continue with that code base and allow extensibility, then we are have to look for some hacks. Or yeah, well, maybe from my opinion, maybe, you know, locking completely application fit doesn't necessarily have to be the best approach in some cases, because okay, you will do some stuff with extensions, but maybe you will actually make much solution that's harder to maintain than just solving some overlaying conflicts.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, okay. Sorry, you want to comment, Dave?
Yeah, sure. I've been taking notes here. So, I mean, Martin's he's nailed a lot of the concerns and issues that I've heard as well from the ecosystem. And we know this is a big impactful project for everybody, really, including us. But so, kind of going back at a few different points. So there are some platform extensibility things that are in the product, like Martin said, you know, like pre and post events for each method and things like that, and various metadata extensions and stuff. But there certainly are still a lot of cases where the product wasn't designed for extensibility. So those are insufficient. You're going to need some sort of hook point in the middle of one of these large methods. Maybe one of these large methods really shouldn't be a large method. It should be several different methods where the pre and post would just work for it. So we've been spending quite a bit of time with some partners. We've worked with some of our largest ISVs, mostly ones that are up on AppSource that have tons of different customizations, both significant in new add-ons, you know, new elements that they've added to the product, but also a lot of places where they've both overlayered and extended to try to source a bunch of requirements, because we know there are a lot of places in the product that we have to build in some better extensibilities capabilities, and so that's what we're working towards. So and just to kind of be concise on what the roadmap is, so we have this idea of a soft seal, which means that you get a compiler warning if you overlayer a model, an element in a model. And then we have the idea of a hard seal, which is a compiler error. So that's at some point, which our roadmap says is the release that is in about 12 months time frame, we're going to have a hard seal of the app suite. So at that point, that's the point that is where the rubber meets the road. You would say that we're going to see more of these things really, really surface this fall with our next release after the one that we're working towards cleaning up right now and releasing is a soft seal on the app suite, which we'll start getting those warnings. Now, there is quite a long life of that fall release. I mean, our support policy says that release is supported for 3 years. So customer doesn't have to move forward to the hard seal spring release if he has some overlayering. But you know, we want people to do that, right? I mean, that's the whole goal of this, is that customers move forward with us. The other thing that we've done with the release that's coming now, our quote unquote spring release, is we've soft sealed a lot of our middle tier models. The platform's been hard sealed since last fall. We've soft sealed some. We have a number of models that are lower level application models, like have our dimensions and some financial things, and our other application frameworks that we've soft sealed now. So that will start coming up. The process of requesting extensibility hooks, Connect is the kind of the de facto way to go about doing that. We definitely do pay attention to those. Those get piped into our internal TFS instance, and they've certainly become part of our backlog. Right now, our backlog's large because we know we have a lot of gaps to fulfill. And we've hit a fair number of them for the spring release, but we have a lot to cover before the fall release in order to add extensibility points. So it may seem like the response is slow and we're not listening, but trust me, we are, and we are going to keep working down that list. Once we get that backlog under control, I think we're going to. We haven't really come to a finalized approach for this, but we're going to have some sort of a commitment, some sort of agreement with the ecosystem that says we're going to address a extension request in a certain amount of time frame. So it's not an open ended type of thing. And I can see there's multiple answers to any extensibility request too, right? There might be some things we say, this isn't something that's going to be upgrade friendly. We have to find a different way to do this. But there's other cases that are just going to be, we're not going to have all of them nailed with the fall release or even the spring release. We're going to still see some things that we've missed that we're going to have to address. And we have to have a policy that enables us to turn that around in a way that the ecosystem can trust, I guess, is where we're going with that. The interesting thing with the platform is we haven't seen a lot of requests like this. But as Martin correctly points out, that's a much smaller scoped lock than what the app suite will be ultimately.
Yeah, because I've heard it been said that Microsoft used a lot of the app source or the ISVs in the beginning to sort of get some sort of telemetry on what would be natural and realistic to extend, and what are they overlaying the most, and for Microsoft to somehow discover where they want to put their extensibility. But like Martin says, there are some huge legacy methods that they are so large and so long, they would obviously, if you wanted to redesign it, you would split it up in multiple methods. And I've seen examples going from R2 to R3 upgrades that in R2 that method was a long method, and in R3 they have split it up and I have to move the code around to make it work. So I got some sort of, and like also like Martin said, sometimes it can be really hard to refactor that code, the legacy code that's already in there, to refactor it without causing some upgrade pains. So
it's frustrating that we have to go through some more breakage to get to a point where we are going to have less breakage. That's ultimately what we have to do, right? To get to a contract that we can support and that provides the ecosystem with the needs to meet their needs. We're going to have to do some refactoring in some places. That's going to be cause some rework and some solutions.
Yeah. And it's also been said that if you postpone your updates, you can postpone them for no more than 12 months, as far as I know. Otherwise, you'll go out of support. Maybe that's just the platform.
That's my understanding, is the platform's a 12-month agreement, whereas the app is a 3-year agreement.
Right.
So you have more time there.
To stay on the soft sealed. And I did ask on the tech conf, if they had any plans on sort of splitting up the application suite and I think it was Badavi who said, no, not really. Or maybe it was you who said, not really. Because I can imagine that you have this huge chunk, this huge model, and the fidelity of this ceiling is on the model level. It's not on the element level.
Right.
So if the entire application suite is soft sealed, then the entire thing is soft sealed.
The entire thing is soft sealed. You know, we've done some model splits, and that's probably caused some churn in solutions as well. We've done that in a lot of cases to facilitate reuse between, you know, kind of break up some of these components.
Okay, yeah, Martin. So Martin, you've done some advanced workshops traveling all over the world, as far as I know. Can you talk about what you do on this workshop, what you present? And because I think I've heard Little Bird say it's fairly advanced. What's in the show you got?
Oh, well. Yeah, well, let me start a bit from the beginning. So, you know, I am not really much, you know, some professional trainer or so, but, you know, people during time started to ask me to give them some training or so. So I started to do some trainings for partners and, you know, give trainings on like development, various topics and TFS, etc. And then at some point, I got into contact with Microsoft regarding AX Accelerate courses for people moving to AX7 with some experience with development, and not necessarily AX, which I don't do anymore. And now I do some advanced development workshops for Microsoft. So in March, I was in Malaysia. Next week, I'm in Belgium. So travel. Whether it's advanced or not, very often people we get there, they don't really have any experience with AX7 yet, and so we can't immediately jump into something extremely complicated, but we want to show a lot, yeah? And that's not done just by myself. I always have somebody from Microsoft, and we do it together. So, you know, I try to add some from my experience, and people from Microsoft obviously have more insight into roadmaps and stuff like that. So we try to combine it to something useful. And we try to show a lot at, you know, you would say that 4 days, that's a lot of stuff, but we have lots of topics. So it's more like, you know, we try to show all the options that people have, or, you know, many of them, and let them to try a few things, so they get some practical experience. But obviously, you can't, you know, go too deep. If you have 20 topics, you just don't have enough time for it. But it's interesting, and I hope it's useful for people. Definitely, you know, if you start, you don't know anything about AX7, and now you hear so many new concepts and some models and packages and data entities, etc. It's, you know, I believe that if somebody goes and actually explain it, and you can ask questions, and that's hopefully useful for people.
Mm.
So how long have you done this course for now?
Well, so far, it was, you know, a bit late start. I was involved in the program from last September, but originally I joined it just to work on content, not really to deliver things. But didn't do that much on content, like in some organized way. So I was in Malaysia, I was recently in Vienna, and now I have two workshops this month. So that's it so far. And I don't want to do it, you know, every week. I have some other work, and, you know, I need to collect some experience to share, of course, and prepare some new demos.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to join that course, where can you go to? Is it booked already? It's done.
Well, as far as I know, you need to go to Dynamics Learning Portal and there, I don't know exactly where it is there. So there is somewhere an option to find these courses.
We'll find. We'll post the links in the description. We'll do some digging and find them for you. So click in the description. You'll find it.
Yeah, maybe I should quickly add that the Dynamics Learning Portal has added more content recently, and I find the new content to be improved and better. But yeah, go ahead then.
So, yeah, I actually was going to ask Martin a question. So, Martin, what as we move from the overlayered model to the extension model, and we talked a little bit about this before, but what do you think that's going to be? What's the impact on the developers and the skills of the developers that are going to be able to do customizations on the product?
Yeah, I think very often it requires designing things in a different way. You know, because people traditionally were used to, here I need to change something, I go there, change the method. And now they can't do it anymore. And they need to start thinking about different ways. I have the recently some example in a forum, but I don't remember it exactly. People want to go and change a method instead of saying, okay, I just can use an event handler, take the object and change it by calling its method. But lots of people are not used to events at all, or the declarative model for declaring events or event handlers. It's quite different. They are not used to accessing objects you take a form and find its data source and work on something on the data source. People are not really used to it. So that's something that they just need to learn. And I see that the lack of object-oriented programming skills and using interfaces and using dependency injection, things like this, that's quite a challenge. And sometimes, if you are using extension methods or class extensions, that's not really obvious what's going on. If you don't see, don't understand what happens behind, it's just magic. So that's always challenging for people. And I think that they really need to learn design stuff differently, and that's never easy. It just needs a bit different mindset. Otherwise, using like table extension to at a field is quite natural. It's actually a very, very nice model now in AX with these visual designers, because in many systems you just declare somewhere something, where you say, okay, and this will have this property. But here you just go in Visual Designer at a field or override some extension, override some property. And it's very, very nice. But with code, it's quite different. And now also there is more and more .NET stuff. So people who don't know .NET will have more and more problems. You can see already AX classes implementing managed interfaces like iDisposable or something and use somewhere in some .NET libraries or run async returns task object from task parallel library from .NET. I think that people should have paid attention to .NET even before, but now it's more and more important. So they can't really escape it. People who know C# now look at all new features in X++ and AX7, and they say, okay, I know all these features already.
That's very interesting. I mean, if you think about all the professionals who maybe like you said, they don't have that much experience with object-oriented programming or .NET programming, but they still they managed to do fairly well because they understood AX and the ERP world, so they could. They now have to go and learn, like you said, more .NET programming. And when a company or a partner ISV onboard .NET developers who are skilled .NET developers and who knows all the ins and outs of .NET world, they should just try to learn ERP and how AX thinks ERP works, and they would manage.
Yeah, well, you know, before people were able to implement stuff, but well, they very often have problems with maintenance, with performance, with extensibility, with upgrades because of poorly designed code. So it worked somehow, but they had lots of problems because of wrong design. So the problem was always there. You are a bit, you know, if you take a .NET developer who worked in like ASP.NET or Entity Framework or so, obviously he is moving to a completely different environment. So having some idea about .NET helps understanding object-oriented programming. It's obviously necessary, but otherwise, of course, they are again moving to different language, to different framework. Even if you talk about about the same language in C#, for example, like, you know, Entity Framework developer knows nothing about the Windows Presentation Foundation, so he needs to learn it anyway, even if it's the same runtime and the same language.
Yeah, I think there's the different development approaches, and it's good insight that being able to get it done and producing something that was good code are two different things. And then the other thing I think we're starting to see, and we're going to see more of, is that we have to go back to the functional requirements and the functional experts to see if there's alternative ways to do something. Because sometimes we get these, you know, what we term as intrusive customizations that require overlaying, and we find it hard to make that non-intrusive from a code standpoint, but then we go back and talk to the functional folks and say, well, no, if we do something further upstream or further downstream that is a little different approach, we can solve the same problem and maybe not even have any customization. So I think that's another area that we're gonna have to see a shift in mindset, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So also I wanted to ask you, Martin, about because you've been with the product with AX since AX3, so you've seen the language, X++ language, has evolved through the versions. And how has that affected the way you work with AX?
Well, I think that changes in language itself weren't very big, actually. There were some changes. What was for me a very big topic was introducing the introduction of .NET Interop in AX4, which greatly simplified, you know, using the .NET libraries. And with every version, it was become easier and easier. You added Visual Studio projects to AOT in 2012. So otherwise, there weren't many changes in language until AX7. Some small improvements. I don't really remember anything too important until AX7. What was important from my runtime perspective that partially, you know, that was step in direction of AX7 was introduction of CIL compilation in 2012. But the language was still the same. That proved that all the code can be run in CIL in .NET, and that's where we are now with AX7. AX7 extended to X++ quite a lot. That is basically that now they can utilize everything but in CIL without, you know, dealing with X++ runtime. And there are many, many nice features. I can't remember anything that would be completely crucial that you can't avoid, you know, you can't work without it. But there are lots of things that will help you, like you want to design immutable objects, you have read only, you have constants, finally, it took so much time before we get there. You have finally keyboard, you can easier work with .NET. You have using for working with iDisposable objects, etc. There are lots of things that I suspect that people who are not used to .NET that don't appreciate immediately. And things like static fields are actually a bit dangerous. So I'm a bit afraid that people will misuse them without knowing what's the impact on garbage collection. So because if you keep something referenced from static field, that will stay there forever until you kill the session. I wouldn't say that it in some fundamental way changed the way how I work. What I'm looking for are some scenarios where, like, now you can define a class in C# and inherit it from X++ and things like that, that potentially could unlock you features that you can write in X++. Or, you know, I'm thinking about I'm looking at some useful opportunity where I would use it. So far, I didn't have any great need for it. It gives you lots of new options. You know, if you want to design things in the old way, in most cases you can. You don't necessarily have to use these new features in language. Mm.
But yeah, and Dave, you've probably seen there is an uptake on using the new patterns introduced in AX7 in their code, replacing previous patterns in previous versions of AX. You mentioned the sys test framework. There are other patterns as well being replaced with new patterns in AX7.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the extension started in AX6 too, right? So we had some extensions in AX6, but those have been significantly improved in AX7. And we have some more platform level capabilities coming out in upcoming updates as well. You know, sys-test has been around for since AX4. But the big thing that we did in AX7 was introduce the form adapter framework. So you could do form-based testing without invoking the UI. So you can do it on the server side. And we've used that extensively internally to improve our test suites. And that's been a huge win for us. So, and the task recorder is new in AX7. So yeah, there's definitely ongoing enhancements to the product that have had impact to the developer ecosystem.
Mm. Great. I'm sort of getting exhausted for questions here, but did you have any questions you wanted to sort of bring out? Because you did have a question for Martin, and it seems like you perhaps have some other questions you want to bring out to the community at large.
Well, yeah, no, it's largely about, you know, what's it going to take to transition from an environment where, you know, basically there is a get out of jail for free card in the fact that you could overlayer as you go through an implementation. So what, you know, from your guys' perspective, what is this change going to do from, you know, all the way through the entire process from the quote stage all the way through implementation? How do you think it's going to impact the partner's way of going about his or her business?
Mm.
From a functional side, I think it's a lot more. You need a lot more prep work, and I think getting an extension and doing doing code changes does have a much higher risk to it now, or at least when you start to code it, you have to know where the extensions are, if there are extensions. So you really have to prep everything and do the functional design a lot more. You can't do the sprints because suddenly if you meet a roadblock, is there, we can't do this because there's a missing extension. You're not coming. You can't go any further.
And hopefully we get to a point where this doesn't completely block you from it, but it's going to slow you down if nothing else, right?
Yeah. And also I see that because what we do a lot now is if we see a bug, we can offer our services to go in and fix that bug before the KB article is there, and then do that afterwards if it's a crucial one. But we can't do that when the code's locked.
Yeah, that's true. I'm also thinking that sometimes when there is a business requirement, some professionals immediately think that, well, we need a customization. And maybe you don't. Maybe it's already supported in the standard. So getting to know what does standard do? Because I'm not a functional consultant, but even I see that going from AX4 to 2009 and 2012 RTM, R2 and R3, there's been added functionality all the way through. So getting to know AX deeply so that you know that what you need, what the process you need to be supported is already supported in standard, and this is the way you do it. There's no need for customization, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you said that earlier as well, that we kind of have to go to the functional guys and see if we can do a process change instead of doing a code change. And
What do you guys think the customer acceptance is going to be? You know, there's going to be situations. I mean, are they going to see the benefits? Are they going to be frustrated if there's pushback on some of their requirements? What's the balance there?
I think the main for me the main issue is that, as Tommy said, there is functionality in the standard service, like product attributes. You can have use product attributes, but the level of getting into using product attributes is pretty high. You have to, it's a very fragmented data model. There's a lot of things that you have to set up to give it going. So instead of having some type of small change to the item cards or adding some additional fields is a lot simpler than going in and deep diving into that specific big sort of solution for product information management. And there's a lot of other places where there is functionality. Say that you need some shipment module. Well, now you have to implement WHS, which is very, very, very big product. So if you want, it's kind of like you want to nibble on one feature or you need one specific functionality, you might have to do a large implementation of an entire module, which is tougher. That's where I see a lot of, at least our customers do customizations that is kind of unnecessary, but it solves their problem in a much easier way, you might say, using a simpler model than what is in
short term for sure, right?
Yeah
And also from the technical side, because you tapped into it, that you want to be able to update the product more frequently. And basically the only way to do that is using the extension model and also going forward with hard sealing more parts of the product. Maybe one thing that I've heard people worry about, and I sometimes worry about it myself, is can we rely on Microsoft providing a hotfix quick enough? Like what Fredrik says, if there's a bug in previous versions, what we could do is that we could actually solve that bug before Microsoft were able to ship their fix. But also, like you said, Devin, you're absolutely right that there are a lot of implementations out there that are not being updated for the sole reason that it's too expensive to upgrade them. And they're pushing those upgrades out. in time, maybe half a year or a year or many years old applications out there. They don't want to do a full upgrade or the full testing phase and what have you.
Right.
And that makes sense. So we want to have the latest and the best version at any time, but we also want to hope and trust that Microsoft is able to ship that hotfix as soon as possible.
Yep, that's completely understood. Yep.
I mean, when we sell the product, what everybody goes in and saying is, we won't do any customizations. That's what we go in and sell anyway. Mm-hmm. So when there is customizations coming, because it's so easy right now. So I think new customers actually like it, because you take away a sort of like a cheat method that you can do in the system, which will be painful in the future. So I would say that saying no customizations in a project is kind of almost like an oxymoron. You say it, but you definitely don't mean it. So going into a project, we have projects saying we won't do any customizations, and I think we are change order like 125 or something like that. So
I think having the customer buy into this approach is really key. I was talking to a partner yesterday who did do a overlayer free implementation, and it seemed like one of the very most important things was that the customer bought into it, and they were asking the question, well, is this going to require overlayering, when they got into requirements discussions, and they got that idea that, okay, well, this is going to be costly long term for us. But I'm sure there's for each customer like that, there's others that want to have certain functionality the way they want to have it.
Yeah, because the bad guys is the functional consultant that goes in and said, well, we can kind of fix it if we just do a small change. It's a teeny tiny change here, and then you kind of get the ball rolling. So I'll take the blame for that. So the salespeople say no changes, and then you start the project, and the functional guys comes in and say, well, I did a customization earlier where we kind of went around this. We can maybe do some type, and there you go. It's
Do you, Martin, have any comments on potential pushbacks from customers on changes?
Well, I'm not really involved too much with like end users or, you know, business owners or so. I think that they really don't, or what I see, they don't really care about these technical details. It's just they want their logic, and doesn't matter how it's done. And yeah, they have problems if they are stuck with upgrades. Usually people don't think that are in advance. but then you see people stuck with some old version, and they are actually making customizations that are already standard features in some newer version, but they just don't want or can't upgrade, and ridiculous. But what I see from developers is, well, most of them are not really happy about it, because, you know, they were used to work in some way, and objectively now lots of things are much more complicated than before, so you can't expect them to be extremely happy to have more work, or they are trying to upgrade their solution and they find that they can't. To do everything with extensions. And, you know, some ISVs are really, you know, they are changing lots of stuff on many places. So it can be a real challenge for them. And my concern in some cases is that, like, you get rid of overlayering and replace it with, you know, some pre and post method event handlers put in some classes, etc. And you actually end up with something that's much more complicated to maintain than if you, you know, you are resolving overlaying conflict and you said, okay, I need to take this line from supplier and I'm done. It has pros and cons as well.
Yeah, there's certainly, you can you can take an extension based model and make it as upgrade unfriendly as overlayering if done wrong. We're trying to, from a tooling perspective, you know, our goal is to minimize the risk there of that happening, but there's definitely cases where we're just, in order to provide the capability that the ecosystem's asking for, there's some trust there as well that the right thing is going to happen, and that's responsibility with trust, right?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I totally get that concern, Martin. That's a valid point. But people are used to being able to customize AX. So
a good thing is that we are getting new extensibility options every version. So and so somebody really needs something, they should shout or you know log it on Connect and vote on ideas, etc. And get some attention to it, and it's especially if it's something generic, then it's something that we should really be vocal about, and hopefully we will get it in some.
We talked about that last time. It was where do Microsoft get their signals on the extensibility? What are their next goals, and what is their sort of like planned order of prioritization? How do you find what next extensions you're going to do and put things into your pipeline?
Yeah, so Tommy mentioned earlier about some, you know, we have some listening systems that are more telemetry oriented. So one of our best sources has been through the app source curation process. So when an ISV wants to get its product in app source, they go through this curation process. And one of the things that they create is a customization analysis report. And that report has all their overlayering instances. And from that, we can get insight into where things are being overlayered. The other place that we're getting a lot of information from telemetry is whenever packages are deployed through LCS, we suck off some information about overlayering and extensions. So we can see as new implementations are happening, you know, both from earlier days where they're going into, say, a dev test environment or a sandbox environment all the way through production, what the makeup is of extensions and overlayering. So we have information coming from that. We also have insight into, you know, what partners are the most active and knowing where to go to ask questions. But then there's, you know, there's the requests that come from the field, both from our ISVs and app source and from partners that we were getting that those requests coming in too, and that's forming our backlog as much as anything else.
I'm just going to throw it out there. I mean, obviously, you don't have any obligations to answer, Dave, but I it would be really cool to see those numbers, to see where people are actually doing their most of the extensibility and extensions.
Yeah.
Maybe one day they will present it.
You know, I can give you some high-level stuff. I mean, it's you know, we have both code-based and metadata-based extensions, but it's tables, classes, and forms, as you might expect, as far as the object types that are the most overlayered. And then from an application standpoint, it's the supply chain areas that have the highest level of customization overall, followed by the financials area. So that's kind of at a high level where things are at. And then, you know, experienced developers, I would guess if you ask them the top 10 forms or tables or classes that get customized, I bet the success rate would be pretty good. You know, we have certain forms, sales order, purchase order, things like that, you know, that are used a lot in the system that are very complex that get customized a lot, and associated tables and classes with those are certainly big candidates for this. So it's good to have the information, though, to kind of confirm your suspicions. And that's one of the great things. You know, as a little bit of a side sidetrack here. Being in test for a long time, it's been a pretty frustrating environment with an ERP product, because you build automation, you do a bunch of testing, you release the product after, you know, in the old days, multi-years of development, and then you don't hear anything, right? It's months before the product gets deployed in any implementation, you know, and even then the listing systems have never been very good. You know, you might hear some things through support or through our, you know, our in-market team that's getting bugs and stuff, but it's really, you really have no idea. And by that time you've moved on anyway, right? It's 12 months later and you're on to the next release or the next project. And with our cloud deployments now and having telemetry and listing systems, it's pretty amazing to be able to get a real-time stream of information. It's still challenging to figure out exactly, okay, what do we do with this? How do we make this better? What are the specifics of it? But it's pretty awesome to have that type of information coming back.
Were there any kind of aha moments that you got from this where you looked at it and thought, oh, the telemetry gave you some insights that you didn't have before? Or is it in a smaller scale? And
well, you know, I'm not thinking any major aha moments right off the top of my head. You know, I think I'll give you a little perspective on some of the challenges that we face. Just looking with this customization telemetry, we had two sources originally. One was the code upgrade tool, which, you know, people run when they're going to upgrade between versions. And that gave us a lot of information, but it's very early in the process, right? So somebody might be taking an AX2012 implementation and throwing all their code from AX2012 to the code upgrade tool, which has a lot of overlaying because that's the way you did things then. So that data wasn't necessarily that trustworthy. So, you know, we could take some value out of it, but it not as much as we want to. The runtime information that I just mentioned a little bit ago is useful, but the challenge there is partners are going to deploy many, many times and to many, many different environments, and trying to remove the duplicates out of that data so that it's weighted properly, it can be a challenge sometimes. So that, and again, that could be early in the implementation process or later. Really, it wasn't until we took the CAR reports, which the problem with that is that they're in, you know, multi-hundred spreadsheets, Excel spreadsheets. They're all on a SharePoint site. And so there wasn't a good way to aggregate all that information until I finally decided one day to go write a script that basically parsed all those files and aggregated all the information and dumped it into a Power BI report that really was trustworthy, right? These are the app source ISVs, and it was one set of information per ISV, and it became good information, right? So, the good news is we got a lot of information coming in. The bad news is we got to still a lot of times work to make it valuable, trustworthy, useful information. So, you know, that's not necessarily an aha moment from the product insight. It's an aha moment that it's not free.
But I bet you enjoyed making that script, though.
You know, over the last couple of years, I've picked up R. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's used a lot by folks doing analytics and data science and stuff. And it's actually surprisingly easy to do some stuff like this, relatively speaking. But yeah, it was a lot of kind of specialized pulling information from here and there and the other place. But it was good to have when it's done.
Yeah, I heard an analogy working with big data that big data is like crude oil, and you got to refine it to kind of get the things that you need from it. You need asphalt. That's it doesn't. You can't just pour crude oil on your roads, right? So,
yep. Yeah. No. That's. But there's value there too, right? That's the other analogy, right? It's there's huge money in this oil, but only when you shape it into something that's valuable.
Right.
Something you could set on fire.
Yes. Yes. Well.
Right.
Anything
else?
Sorry.
One more thing regarding telemetry. I sometimes see customers who are, you know, concerned about telemetry in production environments. So a bit different kind of telemetry. They are afraid that, you know, Microsoft is collecting their data or something. But I'm actually so excited about it. You know, for years I was listening about Visual Studio and Windows. There are things like, and we know from telemetry that people click just at first three items, so we removed the rest because it wasn't useful for people, etc. And I always thought, hey, that's something that I would like to have in AX, that inside what people are actually using, how, you know, maybe we should move things somewhere else, or, you know, find that we invested into feature that nobody actually uses, or people use things that we are not aware of. So yeah, I think it's great that now the data is at least collected. I don't know exactly what Microsoft is doing with it. It's a huge opportunity for, you know, many different scenarios.
Yeah, and we're just getting to the point where we have enough volume in our deployments. I mean, we have a 100 plus live customers now, and so we're getting enough volume and diversity, because we do have to use the information in an aggregate form, right? We're very sensitive to PII privacy type information and the like. So, and you need to have enough volume so that you're not just weighting it to a few customers, the few earlier adopters. So we are starting to collect, you know, get more insights into what parts of the product that people are using, and ultimately, you know, that's going to lead to where we invest and what, even how we can make the product more usable based on the you know, the usage patterns that you see, how people are navigating through the system and stuff like that. So yeah, there's a lot of power there. Yeah, and responsibility, just like I said before.
Okay, I look at kind of like opting out of telemetry is kind of not voting at an election. You've got a small voice, like a tiny voice,
yeah,
but it kind of matters in the big picture. So yeah, if everybody opted out of telemetry, you wouldn't get that good data to make the product even better. So right. It's kind of why I put on all my telemetry, so that the system will at least kind of nudge it in the way that I'm using it, right?
So, your vote counts.
Your vote counts.
You know, yeah. I haven't thought about it when Martin just talked about how Microsoft used the Windows telemetry to enhance the Windows experience. I'm thinking maybe that's why, because one of the things I do in Windows Explorer when I'm browsing files is that I enable showing hidden files and the file extension. And those are now just behind the View tab and two clicks away, basically. And in Windows 2008, you have to go way down underneath the hood to check those checkboxes.
All folder options or how
long? Yeah, exactly. That was horrible. So, yeah, maybe that's why they moved it up there. Who knows?
It's your vote that counted, Tommy.
Yeah, it just got the hotline to Tommy's computer.
One final thing I want to talk to you guys is on AX is integrations, because I've talked to a lot of different professionals about integrations with AX7, and they wonder how is that going to work with now the ERP system being in the cloud. And it is my opinion that integrations will be better now that AX is in the cloud. And so maybe you, Martin, you could talk about what do you think about integrations with AX7? How will you solve them? And what type of technology and platform would you use for integrations now on with AX7?
And definitely what I see is that we now do much more integration than before. Even in 2012, you know, when I started with AX3 and we integrated AX with some web shop, that was something, you know, special. And now every project has several pieces of integration, legacy systems, or, you know, in some cases you have hundreds of business partners where that you want to integrate with. So there is more and more stuff like that. In AX7, it's obviously a bit different. It's in cloud. So some patterns that people use, like, you know, put a file and read it from code directly on iOS, can be done in the same way. But there are, you know, many other opportunities. And I think, you know, it's in many cases, it's more complex. But on the other hand, the integration with Azure services is usually easier. And yeah, now you get things for almost free with like Logic Apps. I mean, you know, from how many changes you need to do. So if you want to run Logic Apps that create records in AX, you just click a few things and you are done. There you can have a gateway reading files on your disk. You can use Azure queues for time decoupled systems. So, you know, if your AX is down for maintenance, you get things into queue and process them later. Logic Apps are basically Bistalk. You can define lots of things there, and you know you have already connectors for a huge amount of stuff. So it's really different a little bit, but yeah, if people accept that if you use like Logic App, you pay something. It's not completely free, but you don't have to worry about servers, etc., about scaling, or so. So I think that makes quite good sense. And now, when you are talking about deployment in Azure, just having the same all these things in the same data center, it's just, you know, easy way how to do stuff. But like if you want to use Logic Apps, you will find that there is actually quite a lot of to learn. So it's not, you know, you have new stuff, new opportunities, new things to learn to be able to use it productively. And I think people really should do it. They will need it. And now people ask, like, okay, how I will communicate with on-premise systems so they are not aware of these gateways or so. So that's, you know, there is no other way than just go to documentation and learn it. And you need some idea about what's possible to be able to design integration solution first. And then you will deal with some details along the way. In some cases, there are things missing from the integration story, like, you know, you don't have these triggers from AX to Logic Apps. So, or CDS is something very fresh and it's not very feature rich so far. So these are like opportunities that will be extended later.
Yeah. Because that you said CDS, and I think part of the plan here is that you're going to integrate more and more to CDS directly. Maybe you want to comment on that, Dave.
Yeah, I see. That's definitely where I think things are going to go. You know, I mean, the data entities are a huge thing in AX7. That is a new piece of technology, and you have that's the source of getting stuff in and out of the system in many ways, right? Whether it's using the DixF framework for import export, or wrapping the entities with no data service so that you're interacting with a web service. But then they're also the mechanism that's ultimately going to pipe data in and out of the CDS service, which will have hook points with other types of services. And that's, you know, directionally where we're going is CDS plus some of the Power App capability. And like Martin alluded to, once stuff's in the cloud, you know, it is hard to bridge that gap between on-prem and in the cloud. But having the data in the cloud does open up some other things like the Power BI integrations that we have now too, because that's another cloud-based service, and it's a much easier integration story to pull that Microsoft technology into the product itself. So it's going to, there'll be some growing pains, but I think you're right, Tommy, that over time the integrations are going to get, they're going to get better and they're going to get easier.
You know, if you start playing with things like Logic Apps, you will often find that there are other Azure services you maybe want to use, like Event Hubs or alerts and Azure Functions, etc. So, you know, if you are starting from scratch, well, it's challenging that there is lots of stuff, but you know, you don't have to develop your own solution for all these things. You just need to connect all these services together, and so you can get lots of really rich functionality, and they that it scales. You don't have to worry about setting up your servers and dealing with geo replication and all that stuff. People like you set up Logic Apps. If you want to know if it fails, so you will create an alert, or maybe you will have Power BI dashboard where you see how your integration is working. There are so it's a different approach, and basically, you know, you won't have everything inside AX as before, or in many cases people have it like that, or maybe some folder with error files that they need to check from time to time. Now, you know, you can get lots of from Azure, from various options that you have there.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you guys so much for being part of our podcast and taking time to do this talk with us. It's been really awesome.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much. So at wrapping up, we always go through where we can find each other's stuff. And Martin, we said it in the intro as well. You are at, is that gooshroom.net/en to find
dev.
It?
dev.gooshroom.net/en.
Yeah. And at gooshroom on Twitter. That's where we can find your stuff. And Dave, you're also on Twitter. I saw that you follow me. I didn't actually follow you until today. I'm sorry about that.
You missed a lot of great stuff, Frederick.
Yeah. Looking forward to...
You might want to catch up tonight.
Dive into the development...
there's not a lot of activity there, but it's at Dave Frosley. I also have a blog out on MSDN that has posts written in spurts. You go back 10 years that was talking about Scrum, and 5 years is probably test stuff. A year ago, I did a lot of test stuff and planning to write some more extensibility stuff as we go forward here.
Yeah. Go in and follow Dave on both the blogs and, of course, on Twitter. And Tommy, you are at Skawa.
Skawa, that's my Twitter. Yeah. And I'm not going to rename my domain name. I don't think I'm allowed to have such a long name. Now the product is, Microsoft is so high on extensibility, so they're keeping extending the name of the product. but it's yet another ax.com. That would just redirect you to my blog. And yeah, on Twitter, at Skawa. That's me.
Yeah, and you can go to my stuff at... GenX Tips. It's actually dyntips.com now. thinking about extending it to Microsoft Dynamics 365 for operations, supply chain, manufacturing, and general operations, enterprise edition.
And the kitchen sink.
Yes. Well, no, it's keeping the domain name short. I've even removed my X now. So it's just dyntips.com. And go check out our website on dynpodcast.com. So it's dynpodcast.com. And our YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/dynpodcast. We've just passed 250 subscribers, going on a steadily increase, and more people are subscribing every month. So that's it's very nice. Hopefully we'll get the momentum to keep going. And we got a lot of interesting things in the pipeline, but everybody at Microsoft is now steadily they're pretty busy with the spring release, which is the kind of the summer release for the rest of the world. But spring release coming up. So when is the spring release, Dave?
When are we releasing?
July.
I think it's July. I don't know the exact date. But yeah, we are, closing it down internally at this point. So.
So when the spring comes to Tommy, that's when they kind of set it up.
That's where our world revolves around. Yeah.
Tommy doesn't see snow. It's time for spring. So
spring is over.
We're looking.
We have a late summer. It's in due for a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice. Looking forward to that. And of course, go check out dynamics.com for more information about the Dynamics products. We'll talk to you later, guys. Hopefully we get you on another time. It's been great talking to you. So see you later.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Thank you.